I was asking the people in San Diego, because that was real nostalgia, Bill, down there, just how far we had come from that time 25 years ago when that church was established, and it was the first fruits of Ambassador College, a tiny, struggling little college here in one building that had 26 students when I registered as a freshman. And looking back over the course of world conditions and of developments even inside the church over that 25-year period, it was very nostalgic to sit there and reminisce about the days we used to get in the automobile when we lived down here about where the some of the club rooms are in the student center in a little redwood house. And we would go and pick up the pianist and maybe one or two other brethren or a student or two that would always ride down. We would take Mark and put him in a car. David and Matthew weren't born yet. And we would drive down to San Diego. And it was always nostalgic for me to do that because I'd spent nearly 2 years down there in a naval auxiliary air station before I got aboard that aircraft carrier. So I knew San Diego fairly well in the Navy. And I go back down there and we go into a little old Dartley Hall, a dank, empty, you know, kind of a little tiny hall. Wasn't even half as big inside as this stage. And had old wicker chairs in it and an old upright piano. We had to pray for people in the bathroom, kneeling in front of the bathtub. And it was more like an old living room, I think, of a private home that had been turned into a public hall when the church was begun by Rod Meredith, and I don't believe he was even ordained at the time. I think that he was just a graduate student and perhaps was still a student. I'd have to ask him. I forget the exact details there. There were 7 or 8 people in attendance. And then by the time I was going down there a year or two later, I think there were about 15 to 20 people in regular attendance. Matter of fact, that's where I first met Mrs. Rona Martin and her grandmother, who was 100% Cherokee Indian, and her mother, who is still alive, I believe, and I think in, I guess she's in relatively good health. I haven't checked the last few days. But I'll never forget that occasion because Rona and her mother had had some Pentecostal teaching in their background, and I was flailing away on one sermon, and these two blackly, 3 of them, came in and sat down in the rear, and I had never seen them before. Of course, I was just a scared young preacher sort of practicing on these San Diego people. And I would make some point or other out of the Bible, and that God says thus and such, and I heard these 3 people say amen back there in the crowd, you know. And then I went on a little while and said something else, and oh, yes, praise the Lord, you know. And they were, oh, my, yes, amen. And I went along a little further, and it kept getting sort of a little louder, and it was kind of like it was, action-reaction, or like I would say something, and sort of, I got to expecting their response, and I found out that I was sort of pacing my sermon based upon these 3 ladies back there. So, boy, that was a strange experience for me. I'd never had that happen before. After the service, I went over and quietly talked to them, and I said, ladies, we don't do that here in this church. We would prefer that the audience remain silent, and we don't really ask the people to say amen and all of this and speak out loud. And I'll never forget Rona's answer. That was her very first visit, or maybe the second or whatever, to church. And she says, oh, Brother Armstrong, if we held our peace, even the rocks would cry out. And so I said, well, Mrs. Martin, I'll tell you what, you go ahead and hold your peace, and we'll just listen to the rocks next time. But anyway, takes me back. I remember that we would always stand outside, visit with the people. They always had an awful lot of questions. That was when Mr. and Mrs. Weichel first came into the church down there. Mr. Weichel came up here and worked for us in the carpentry shop for many, many years and did a fabulous handcrafted lamp that is in my office that I'm really very proud of and pleased to have. Mr. Weichel finally died, and a lot of the older families that I remember, either dead or moved away, only 1 or 2 of them were there, and they received a silver goblet. I think we had a pretty good coverage of that event in the worldwide news, so you can read all about it. But it really did take me back to realize how rapidly this period of time had gone by, because that's just like yesterday to me. I can telescope all these years from the early days of Ambassador College, of approximately 80 to 100 people meeting in the library building up there when we would go down a little tiny fledgling church in San Diego. We had about 50 or 60 people meeting up in Eugene, Oregon. We had a tiny group meeting up in Portland, Oregon. And that was the extent of the Church of God. Eventually, we outgrew the college library. We opened up that big sliding door, and we were in both of those rooms, and we went over and we rented the old Shakespeare Club that I believe is gone. I don't think it's even there anymore. I think that's been raised or leveled. And they have a new building over in here somewhere, I think, or a different building. And for many years, we preached to a fairly packed house over there. Well, of course, gradually, the church was growing all across the Southwest and over in Texas. And I think of the time when I first went over to preach in the Feast of Tabernacles, 1953, in the fall, in that old Redwood building, and I was flailing away about the children that were all out of hand. They were running all over the place and yelling and screaming, and half of the mothers were outside burping and changing the babies, and the kids were gnawing on Dad's shin or something, and it was absolute bedlam, and you could hardly hear yourself think. So I stood up there and preached a powerful sermon about child-rearing. Well, for some reason, that branded me as a child-rearing specialist. And so thereafter, I began talking a great deal about it, and I made that a source of study. And on up in college, I went, got me two library cards, and I would come back with about 8 or 10 books or whatever at a time, and started working on my master's thesis on that subject that later became a booklet, which I think needs revision, but which we still have. I began to think of those days in the 1950s when in the Plain Truth magazine there were articles coming out almost all the time that Germany will rise again. And we talked about American Marshall Plan dollars rebuilding Central Europe. I remember quoting some of the leading politicians of that day who were very fearful about what they called a calculated risk. And even Walter Lippmann, who once said that once we have asked the Germans to bear arms for Americans and to face the East as a bulwark against the Warsaw Pact of Nations, the Germans are firmly in the driver's seat. And I began to collect books on that subject that I still have, probably 20 of them or so. I read Ernst von Salomon's Fragebogen, which was translated into English. It was quite a sensational bestseller in Germany back in the 50s because Fragebogen, as you German-speaking people know, means questionnaire. And it was a takeoff on the questionnaire by the occupying powers that asked everything on down to the name of your paternal grandmother's maiden name and was supposed to be a part of the American, the British, and the French denazification program in Western Germany. I was quick to point out in those years in the 50s that the denazification program was turned over to the German authorities in 1947. In 1947, the Germans began to denazify themselves. Every time we saw something happening in world trade, or we went down and we saw the avalanche of trade goods and trucks and everything pouring into Chile or Central or South America, or we heard of some new surge in the West German economy, we would make a great article about that. We would really be alert and attentive to what was happening in world affairs. Because you see, back during that day, we knew that the United States of America, Canada, South Africa, Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, and the democracies of Northwestern Europe comprise the nations of Israel in the Bible. That they are the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And we would even strive through a process of elimination in classes in Ambassador College to identify the remainder of those tribes, not only Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh that we know to be the United States and Britain, but also other nations such as Gad and Issachar, Dan, Zebulun, Naphtali, and the other races of people that occupy some of those parts of Europe. When we would discover in history, for example, that 200,000 Jews had been removed by an Assyrian king and taken to a peninsula in northern Europe, and later that name that it bore, called Jutland, or Jutland, J-U-T-L-A-N-D, later called the Mark of Dan, and still called that today, Danmark. That sure enough, not only did Jewish people go there and later on crop up in England and Ireland, but so did some of the Danites, who had the practice of naming places where they went after their own forebearer's name. That's common in the United States. Many of our states are named after Indians or Indian chiefs, or maybe even European monarchs, such as Louisiana. And so you have Louisiana, as they call it down there, but it was named after Louisiana of Spain. We have various names like Iowa, named after the Kiowas. And we have various counties like Multnomah up in Oregon that was named after an Indian chief. People name lands and buildings and houses after themselves. When the city of Lachish fell and the Danites in northern Israel took it, they renamed it Dan. And in the Bible, from then on, you would find that the borders of ancient Israel were called from the northern Dan to Beersheba, north to south. And so when we discovered that Dan abode in ships, and we saw that there were even rivers in southern Spain called in the Hebrew, or I should say in this case it would be an Arabic tongue, the Wadi El Heber. That was corrupted into the Spanish language of Guadalquivir, which today is a river in southern Spain, the Guadalquivir River, Wadi El Heber anciently. And then we found some of these interesting little sidelights. Now the sidelights were just piquant points of interest. When I first got to go to Europe, went over to England in 1956, I couldn't wait to get into some of those old musty bookstores of London and browse around and find some of these old books. And I had a membership in one of these ancient old Bible book houses, and I would get a whole box of those about once a month from my private library at home, but I still have. And I was really searching into this thing of Liophel. I wanted to find out about Jeremiah and the mysterious king's daughters and find out about them coming up to Ireland. I'd read in the Bible about this great stone and how it would be overturned, and no more overturned until he came whose right it was. And I was looking at some of these most ancient scriptures way back here in the book of Genesis, and I was really alertly excited about trying to find modern-day demonstrable proof to back up what I had read in the United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy booklet, which was, incidentally, the first booklet I ever read. I'll take you back to a part of that. In Genesis, the 12th chapter, for example, you can read how Abram had his name changed. The Eternal had said to Abram, "Get thee out of thy country," verse 1, "and from your kindred and from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation." Now, you know the word nation means kingdom. It comes in the Latin, the same word, natividad, which is the word for Christmas, by the way, in the Spanish language, really means birth. And nativity and nation, and we have natal and postnatal and prenatal care, has to do with birth. It would mean a great family, a great nation. Every nation, unless it is politically, of course, today amalgamated and homogenized, is basically a family of people, a tribe of human beings grown great into a nation or a political entity. That's what a nation is. "And I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing." I asked the people in New Hampshire the other day, just to muse for a moment about world history of the past couple of decades or better, what would the world be like if there had never been an England? And I had to think about the Magna Carta and the Chartists and the great riots that they had, of how the British people gave us our birthright and our heritage, of how the British people, in breaking away from the papacy, the Church of England, the church whom the royal leader of Britain became the head, in defying the continental power of the papal-crowned line of kings in France, the Frankish and the Habsburg kingdoms and others, how Britain offshore Europe was able to survive the Hundred Years' Wars and many other wars that Britain herself, because of her strategic location across the Channel, actually effectively bottled up Europe and became a strategic sea gate. That British Channel had been the salvation of those people for so many years. And how they expanded to fulfill some of the prophecies we're going to read right here. As I read a little of this, you might just wonder what India might have been like today if the British had never been in India. Now, we can argue about all the, you know, the self-righteous breastbeating of today, the dismantlement of colonial empires, all the while we do that and wash our laundry before the rest of the world, and we expunge the ancient sins of our forebears, and we rip the pants off of our public heroes in public, including the founding fathers and every member of government today. We also look back in our history and we apologize. We apologize to the Panamanians for recognizing a quick puppet government and ripping that isthmus away from Gran Colombia and sending our battleships down there to protect it. We're guilty, we feel, and we've got to give it back. We apologize to the people of India, that vast nation, for the British East India Company, and for all the rip-off and the exploitation of those poor peoples in India. But today in India, there are more people speaking the English language, and to have at least close to somewhat of a democratic government. More people speak the English language in India than in England. And the nation of India is a major world power possessing the atomic bomb. And the nation of India would still have been a cow dung society without the British Empire. Because the British Empire If you would look back into the maps of the 1914, 18, 20s, and even after World War I, when some of the German East African highlands of Kenya and Tanzania, formerly called Tanganyika, were taken away from the Germans as a result of the Treaty of Versailles, and the British ended up with East African highlands and some of the mandates of the South Pacific, like the Gilberts and the Marshalls that were former German possessions. You could look at a map after World War I, and they always colored the British, let's say, possessions, colonies, or lands red, and then the protectorates were always a sort of a bright pink. Now, they don't do that anymore because of the communist connotation. But the maps of that era would have shown you Britain, Canada, Australia, South Africa, Rhodesia, Tanganyika, Kenya, Aden and Eden, Yemen, at the end of the southern approaches to the Red Sea and therefore the Suez Canal, that the British bottled up the entirety of the southern approaches because not only that, but they had the total possession of Egypt, and the Sudan was called the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. It was colored bright pink. They occupied, of course, Egypt and had Suez, Cyprus, Malta, Gibraltar, the approaches to the western end of the Mediterranean Sea. They had the Straits of Malacca, access to Singapore and the flow of shipping traffic in Indonesia. The Dutch had the Dutch East Indies and were one of our major allies in World War II in a nation that was in exile, its government in exile and occupied. The British, with Hong Kong and Singapore, the Straits of Malacca, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the southeastern Asia and the Indian Ocean area, Trincomalee, Colombo, Ceylon, some of the big naval bases of that time. Really, the British Empire and eventually the British Navy, first in the days of wooden ships and men of iron of Anson and Frobisher and Drake, and later on in the pre-World War II era, where the British had a massive and a powerful navy and a very vast fleet that sailed the seas of the entirety of the world, bottled up effectively many of those nations that long since have risen to take a position of world power and authority. Why? You have to ask who we are. What is our heritage? Can you find in history a relationship between people who look the same, who have the same origins, who tend to talk and act somewhat the same, and in spite of their differences, in spite of a revolutionary war and the breakaway 13 colonies of the United States of America, and the War of 1812, and difficulties that we have had since, you cannot point in history, and you cannot point anywhere on this world, whether you look at Chinese and Japanese, and the most Americans, they all look alike, or whether you look at some of the various peoples of Southeast Asia and the Chinese who tend to look alike, and they hate each other. You cannot point to a relationship that spans the centuries in the way that that of Britain and the United States does. Bear these things in mind and think what the expansion, and now, of course, the collapse of the British Empire has meant to the rest of the world. Because it said here, not only would Abraham's name be made great, but he would be a blessing, would be a blessing to many other nations. And I will bless them that bless thee. And there are precious few that do that. But those that have been blessed. Look at the Philippines as an example. When Dewey opened it up in the Spanish-American War, the Philippines became virtually an American possession. Now, of course, they're independent. But nevertheless, our work is there because of a large increment of the Philippine population that speaks English. About 14% of them speak Spanish, and many of them have Spanish names. And where Israel was, where we had bases, and in one sense, another of the major sea gates because of its strategic location, which is why the Japanese took it so early in the war, that was very important, and it did affect world trade and world geopolitics. I will bless him that blesses you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. So we read a little later on in the 17th chapter, the reiteration of that, when Abraham was 99, the Eternal appeared before him and said in verse 1, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me, and be thou perfect. Now, a lot of people think that's a New Testament doctrine, that Jesus said we are to achieve perfection. Well, according to the Old Testament, in this scripture, in the 17th chapter of Genesis, walking before the Ten Commandments of God, long before the giving of the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, the ancient patriarchs, Noah, those that went before him, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all knew about God's law. They knew about the Sabbath. They knew about tithing, and they practiced it. You can find over and over again, we used to do that in second year Bible class that I taught, to put it on the board and show an example of every single one of the Ten Commandments and how it was known that it was a sin to break it and it was punishable by the penalty of death prior to the giving of the law on Mount Sinai in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus. He said, "Walk thou before me and be perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and thee, and I will multiply thee exceedingly." Abraham, or Abram as his name still was, fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations." Now there is not the remotest shadow of doubt in the minds of anyone, of any biblical scholar, but that Abram, because you can look in the genealogy of Jesus Christ in Luke 1, you can look at the genealogies elsewhere in the Bible. You can look at the Old Testament. Everybody knows he was a Semite. In other words, he came from Shem. He's not from Ham or Japheth. He's not of the black or the yellow races. He is a Semite. His lineage and his genealogy is mentioned in the lineage of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Now, no one can claim that Abraham was a Jew, because no Jew had ever been born yet. Judah was one of the sons of Joseph, or Jacob, rather, Isaac and Jacob. And, of course, along with Joseph, all of the other children that were born, including the girls, there were many, only one or two might have been mentioned, but Judah gave to the Jewish people the nickname Jew. Abraham was the great-grandfather, Isaac the grandfather, Jacob, of course, coming along the father. So he said, "Your name is going to be great, and you're to be a father of many nations. Neither shall your name anymore be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham," because that's what it means. A father of many nations is what Abraham means. "And I will make you exceeding fruitful, and will make nations," that's families of people grown great into a political entity, "nations," plural, "of you, and kings," dynasties of kings, that's racial as well as national, "shall come out of you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto you and to your seed after you. And I will give unto you and to your seed after you the land wherein you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Now it's repeated time and again throughout the book of Genesis, but let's go to the point where finally he was tested right on to the point where he was going to give up his own son in the 22nd chapter. And finally God said, "Now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your own son." And so he reiterated the promise beginning in verse 16 of chapter 22. "By myself have I sworn, says the Eternal, for because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven." It's not talking about Christ, as some scholars like to claim. It is talking about multiple national, racial blessings of vast numbers of human beings. The stars of heaven are countless. They now feel, and science feels, that there are about 200 billion billion in our galaxy alone, and that there are perhaps billions of galaxies, which of course boggles the mind. So we aren't even beginning to grow on up to the ultimate proportions of the size of the seed of Abraham that are promised in this scripture. "As the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed," the seed that was to be multiplied, that plural seed, that racial seed, "shall possess the gate of his enemies." And we have. Now the United States, of course, is giving up one of those. But all of those, the Straits of Malacca, Gibraltar, the Khyber Pass, the possessions of the strategic islands of the Pacific, of the Atlantic, of all of the inland seas, and the very location of nations of Israel itself, such as where the Skagerrak and the Kattegat come together and bottle up the Baltic between Denmark and Sweden, have for many centuries effectively controlled world trade and have been the decisive factor in world wars. We knew that back in the 1950s. You know, when I was over in New Hampshire, I mentioned this in sort of a different context, and I said, "We used to know this, we used to know that," and I said, "Do we still believe that we are the people of Israel?" Back there in the audience, two little old sweet ladies, gray-haired, smiled sweetly and shook their heads, "No." And I thought, ghastly, really? Maybe they were just visitors, I assume they were, because they knew that I was going to be there or something. And I thought, well, you know, maybe some people don't really believe we are Israel anymore. And I just wanted to go over that briefly with you, because I do believe we are Israel. I have proved it absolutely, incontrovertibly, over and over and over again. And after the intellectual proof, after the biblical truth, after the trunk of the tree of the promises of the book of Genesis, you can go on to add a lot of the supportive little branches and twigs that are the interesting and the more piquant, perhaps, just for their unusual character. You would have to find somewhere on this earth some other race of people to satisfy this description. You would have to find some other collection of people who are brothers, who look alike and have basically the same traditions, and have all of that tremendous backdrop of very amenable relations geopolitically. You would also have to find somewhere on this earth, where would you look? Himalayas? You would look up in Nepal, perhaps, in China, Japan, Central South America, some African country like maybe Idi Amin. Where, even in Africa, do you find a king who is crowned while sitting on a rock? Anybody know? No, you don't, because there isn't any such thing. You never heard of it before in your whole life. But here is the modern space age nation of Britain. And I saw with my own eyes, I heard on the radio as a boy of about 5, the coronation of her father. But I saw with my own eyes on national and international television the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II of Britain. And she was sitting on a rock. The stone that anciently was called Liophail is still underneath, right there in the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey. It was stolen once. But you would have to answer, why, when Jacob set up his pillar stone, a stone that he poured oil over when he had that marvelous dream that showed him the connection between God and mankind, and once again reiterated these same promises to Jacob, the child of Isaac and the grandson of Abraham, that stone was carried by the ancient Israelites, and that stone apparently was taken along with Jeremiah and one of the king's daughters to ancient Ireland. Now, it isn't my fault that I was able to discover in some of those musty old London bookstores books in which I could identify that the earliest settlers in the nation of Ireland were called the Tuatha de Danann, D-A-N-A-A-N, Tuatha de Danann, meaning the tribe of Dan. Neither was it any accident, and it wasn't my fault because I didn't manufacture the material, that I found there was a belief in a funny ancient stone that was called the moaning or the crying stone, because tradition had it that when an ancient king of Scotland or of Ireland was crowned over it, the stone would actually groan aloud. And it was called Liophail. Liophail, L-I-A-F-A-I-L, spelled backwards or forwards, either way, the same way. And I looked up all of those interesting things. I found out about some of the places that Dan had left his name. Others scoff about that. They say that isn't true. Just because you find the Danube, the Danube River, or the Dniester, or the Dnieper River, or you find all along those valleys from between the Black and the Caspian Sea, clear over into north central and northwestern Europe, the name of Dan practically everywhere, that you find Londonderry and Dunedin and Dunedin and London and so on, all through the English language. Plus, you find the people of Denmark, their stamps don't say Denmark like we do in the United States. That's a corruption. Their stamps say Danmark, Mark of Dan, and that's what they're still called today. Now, that's not significant to somebody that wants a theological argument, who just will not believe that we are the people of Israel because they don't want to believe the warnings against our people. You've got to believe we have the blessings. You've got to believe that one square yard of Iowa soil would be worth a national park in Kenya, Tanganyika. You've got to believe in the sea gates of Britain and the United States and the fact of the greatness of the British Empire, and you've got to believe we won World War II. You've got to believe that we have been a blessing to the rest of this world, that we have been magnanimous and generous almost beyond belief in the modern world today, to our own detriment. But for some reason, there are theologians who want to argue that we are not, that we couldn't be Israel, that we are Gentiles. The fact that the vast majority of white American families practice the rites of circumcision is not even in the least instructive to these theologians. That's no proof. They even stray away from the trunk of the tree and refuse to look at the scriptures that we just read. I happen to know that we are Israel and that we are still Israel today. when we were preaching back in the 50s about what was happening in Germany and in Europe, wondering about a Frankenstein monster created by our own Marshall Plan dollars, we got very loud, very vociferous, very insistent. We preached some rather violent warning, almost threatening sermons about what we're going to do when the Germans show up over here. Of course, a lot of people didn't believe that very well. Mr. Meredith likes to tell about the nurse that had been a hard-bitten old army nurse that had spent several years in Germany, and of course she'd seen all the rubble over there, so he was preaching down in San Diego one day in old Dartley Hall, and he'd finished the sermon on prophecy and about Germany will rise again, and she came up to him and said, "That's nuts." Those are the exact words that she used. He'll never forget that because you just didn't talk to a young minister that way in those days. Somebody come up and say, "That's nuts," to a minister was in trouble. And she says, "That's nuts. I've been over to Germany. I have lived there. I've seen it. Germany will never rise again." Well, Sir Winston Churchill said it wouldn't rise again in 50 years, and he'd been there too. I don't think the Germans believed it was going to rise again. Where is it today? Where is Germany today? How big is she? How powerful? How viable? How strong her industry? Her currency is stronger than ours. She has far greater reserves. She is more economically viable and powerful than we are. But we won World War II, didn't we? Well, and Mannheim and Wuppertal and Mainz, all up and down the length and breadth of East and West Germany, 80%, 70% rubble. Just mounds of bricks as far as you can see. Total destruction. A massive destruction unleashed on those peoples as a result of massive nighttime saturation bombing by the British and the daytime strategic bombing by the Americans. And those cities were reduced and leveled to absolute rubble. And so people speculated Germany could never rise again. Well, to go a little further back into nostalgia for a moment, way back in the 1930s, my father, Herbert W. Armstrong, was preaching on the radio about a coming beast power. He was writing articles in a little hand-cranked mimeographed Plain Truth magazine that there would be the beast rising up in Europe. That was one of his headlines. Now, he, as looking from the point of view of the progress of World War II, as viewed in the prophecy of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, came to a certain conclusion. He saw what happened in the early part of World War II. The unbelievable German blitzkrieg that very quickly gobbled up most of Europe. It partitioned Poland because of a secret non-aggression pact that had been signed in Italy between the Soviet Union and the West and the German government. And so Poland fell, but along with it, so did the Sudetenland before that and Czechoslovakia, and the entire area of the along the Baltic, which was one of the major problems of the former Treaty of Versailles, the Danzig Corridor. So Lithuania and all that area went, and Hitler took over France, and Poland, and Holland, and Luxembourg, and Denmark, and Norway, and Sweden, and virtually all of Europe was swallowed up under the Nazis. Occupied Holland. Tony van der Leeden's probably here somewhere. As a boy of about 11, he remembers that very well. The Germans in his country. If you saw that movie, which was rather well done, it couldn't obviously give the whole battle the way it was written by Ryan, who was one of the foremost historians and magnificent writers that I've ever read. His research spans decades, and he's an incredible writer, called One Bridge Too Far. It's a motion picture out now. It's rather bloody, rather realistic in many ways, but actually is one of the greatest blunders that the Allies made in one of the most costly airborne and the largest airborne invasion in the history of the world. There has never been the like before, and there never will again, because that type of warfare is now over. But my father was viewing the world from his position in Eugene, Oregon, in a very, very dark, very, very pessimistic manner. The Americans had nothing to rejoice about in 1942, about February or March, because Wake Island had gone, Guam had gone, the Marshalls and the Gilberts were occupied by the Japanese, they'd taken the Solomons, they had half of New Guinea, Buna, Goa, looking over the forest at Fort Moresby. They'd already bombed, or did very shortly thereafter, Darwin. They had taken away all of our island possessions, save Midway, and that was a great and a vast turning point. But they'd gobbled up all of the Philippines very quickly, Malaysia, the Dutch East Indies, they were all gone. Timor, They had the oil at Balakpapan. They had the tin mines and the rubber plantations of Indonesia. The Japanese had come down overland to take Singapore from the rear. Giant 18-inch cannon all in place pointing out to sea to guard the Straits of Malacca. The Japanese came with their bicycles in two pieces on their backs. And their rice rations and their ammunition was gone when Percival gave up the island or the peninsular bastion. Read the story. They expended their last round of ammunition in that final artillery barrage on a vast gamble, and the Japanese general won, because that was it. And so far as Percival and the others there that were on the beleaguered peninsula knew, the Japanese would just keep coming. Well, they gave that up. And so little yellow men of that part of the world learned a brand new lesson. They've been learning it ever since. That the foreign devils, that may be bigger and may have a lot of strange machines that they'd learned from the days of Dewey and before, and the opening up of some of the Chinese trade areas, could be whipped by the Orientals. They could be beaten. That lesson is not lost on them today. It was learned once again by the Oriental peoples in Korea, and it was learned once again, underlined in bright red with exclamation points, in Vietnam. And don't think for one minute that the modern problem of Korea isn't going to come along to plague the United States government and the people of this country once again, because it is. Well, at that time, the German army was in northern Africa. People in Alexandria, Egypt, on a clear night, could see the flash of the guns. Now, just beyond Alexandria, of course, lies the Suez Canal. The British had Syria, Aleppo. There was a major battle there, as a matter of fact. The British occupied the modern nation of Israel, or then called Palestine. The British were in Egypt and the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. The British had Gibraltar, as I said, and Malta, and Cyprus. But Italy, all of Europe, Germany together, and the axis that they drew on a line, imaginary on a map, of course, called the Axis Powers, between the Japanese government and those of Germany and Italy, it seemed were gobbling up the world. Tremendous amount of China was in Japanese hands. The Burma Road had been cut, and we were flying over the hump to relieve some beleaguered Chinese. And major cities, even in the nation of India, including Calcutta and Rangoon in Burma, had been bombed. Now here we were in this situation with only India standing between the Japanese Empire and the Persian Gulf oil and the Suez Canal, with a vast German army already in northern Africa heading toward the Suez Canal, with all of Europe gone, and with the United States desperately playing catch-up, trying to convert to wartime footing when we had been isolationist and peacetime footing in our industry. And there was a preacher named Herbert W. Armstrong who believed that we are Israel, and who believed the Bible, and who believed God, and who believed that prophecy is for our time, and believed that we are living in the time of the end. And he read in the 11th chapter of Daniel, because in his young lifetime, before my time, he had known of oil. It was in my time. He was up in his 40s, but I don't remember it very well, because it took place in about 1934, 35, 36, along in there. I was 4, 5, and 6 years of age when Menelik, the king of Ethiopia, I don't even know what he did, but I do know that Mussolini went in there, and that the ancient old trimotor junkers and other aircraft that would look like ancient antiques of this day bombed cities in Ethiopia, and that Ethiopia was taken over, along with Somaliland, by the Italian armies, and they flooded into Ethiopia. Now it says here, beginning in verse 40 of Daniel 11, at the time of the end shall the king of the south, and there was a king on the throne of Ethiopia, push at him meaning the king of the north, and we knew that that was a major European power, that is known anciently as the Syrian kings of the Seleucids or the Seleucidae of Syria, but identified, and you can go back if you want just an interesting statement or two here to show you the unbelievable parallels of the almost exact repetition, because there's type and anti-type, there is duality, there is double fulfillment oftentimes in prophecy. Take a look at what it says here in verse 20 of that chapter. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. The Hohenzollern family of Germany meant tax collector. In the glory of the kingdom, the Tsar, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. The original one was poisoned. His name was Heliodorus. But anciently, I mean, I should say anciently, Heliodorus was poisoned, but the antitype of that in our modern time, back in World War I, was in exile, and it was removed. And in his estate to take up the reins of that government shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in through flatteries in a time of security and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. An obvious reference to Adolf Hitler. And with the arms of a flood shall be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the Prince of the Covenant. The Prince of the covenant people, will have a prince ruling over them. I won't launch into a great diatribe on the 22nd chapter of Isaiah and the identity of Shebna and whether or not Queen Elizabeth is either going to survive or abdicate and whether or not her oldest son is going to take the throne. I have believed that privately for more than 20 years. I've spoken of it sometimes over past 12, 15 years ago. I used to. Don't make a lot of reference to it right now because I don't want to stick myself out on a limb too far, but I still think, I say think, that that may happen. But the important point to recognize is that here you have an obvious reference to the Kaiser of World War I and the reference to Hitler of World War II, and after that time, knowing that finally this was Antiochus Epiphanes anciently who set up the abomination of desolation in the Holy of Holies and sacrificed swine's blood there and desecrated the temple, that from the time of the introduction of that vile person, anciently Antiochus Epiphanes and in World War II, Hitler, the personality never changes from that time on to the end of that longest biblically prophetic chapter. The personality never changes. So back in verse 40, it said, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. Now my father would on the radio talk about a new kind of warfare that the Germans had invented. And they call it Blitzkrieg because Krieg means war. The Kriegsmarine is the German war marine, or in other words, the Navy. Blitz is lightning and Krieg is war. Lightning warfare. The idea of very rapidly moving armored columns slicing completely through an enemy territory behind his troops, cutting off and isolating them, going around major cities, and so on, a tactic later on used by our own General Patton and others with rapidly moving armored divisions in World War II, will come against him like a whirlwind. There was Blitzkrieg that was being practiced with chariots, and obviously that's an ancient type of vehicle, but today would mean tanks and trucks and the modern mechanized methods of war, and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over. Now my father had seen Ethiopia occupied by the Italians and Somaliland. And he shall also enter into the glorious land, that king of the north. And so he saw Hitler's armies in northern Africa. And it says here that eventually those armies would go into Palestine. And many countries shall be overthrown, and many have been. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, all of Central Europe, and so much of the Southeast Asian area. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. And they had. Turkey was playing both ends against the middle, and they're Edom. Esau, the Turks, easily identifiable in history. And the nation that is now called Jordan, and before that, Transjordan and the Syrian area were protected and in the hands of the British people. And they weren't gobbled up by Japanese or by the Soviet Union or by any other force. And they remained under British and American protection. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And German armored divisions were already in Egypt. They were already in Egypt. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Then it said, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, obviously Jerusalem, and he shall come to an end, and none shall help him. If you had been armed with the knowledge that we are Israel, that Bible prophecy means today, and you had seen the world as it really was, as I've tried to give you a brief bird's eye view very quickly,
What would you have assumed was about to happen in the Middle East? I would have assumed that the Germans and the Japanese were going to link up in Jerusalem, in Palestine. And I would have been preaching, if that happens, and if you see then the Pope move over to a city that will be open and declared an international city after that, then this great final day of the Lord battle, referred to in verse 44, tidings out of the north and the east, is going to begin. Because we were already suffering a great tribulation. It's tribulation when you're in a vast, global, worldwide war with hundreds of thousands of your people dying. It's tribulation when the people were diving into their storm cellars and down into the depths of the tubes or the subways in London and the big cities of England with the wail of those sirens proclaiming that Nazi bombers were overhead. When you were walking along and suddenly a V-1 came screeching out of the skies and exploded, or a V-2 came down from outer space and exploded. The first time that rockets were used in warfare was the innovation of Wernher von Braun, who later became the head of the United States space program, but invented those destructive weapons, more a terror weapon than any real destruction because of inaccuracy, but still, they took an awful lot of lives. That was a tribulation, a real problem for our people. So my father began preaching exactly that. But then came El Alamein. Then came the counterattack by Montgomery and the Eighth Army of Britain. And then eventually came the American landings at Casablanca. And the German armies and the Italian armies were either captured or driven out of North Africa. And so their drive toward the Suez was halted. And right then, in 43 and in 1944, when I was 13 and 14, my father began preaching, the Germans will go underground. Leading German leaders, Nazis, will disappear. They will go into hiding. They will change their identity. They will flee to other countries. Some of them will remain inside of Germany. He said, Germany must rise again. And he said that while Allied bombers were busily pounding German cities to rubble. So when I come on the scene and I began to study about Israel, and I began to learn about world conditions, and I began to remember what I'd learned in World War II as a teenager, a lot of it became very vivid to me. And I began preaching along with all the other early pioneer ministers in the church, Germany is going to rise again. When I first went to Germany, I couldn't believe my eyes. We got a chance to go over to Berlin. I was able to see East Berlin and to see that unbelievable rubble. And over here on the one hand was West Berlin, a glittering, beautiful, revitalized, rebuilt, fantastic city with only one old church that they'd kept and kind of preserved with a partially destroyed state as a kind of a national monument of sorts and a brand new church right beside it. I go into great cities like Some of the very ones where we've had our offices, not only Bonn, but Dusseldorf especially, a glittering gem of a modern, unbelievable city, and see that, and yet see the unbelievable rubble on the other side of the border, and it just dazzles your mind. You just can't believe it, that it's happened. And when I first went over there, we went over in 1956, that's a long time ago, there was a great deal of evidence of World War II still around. We drove from Belgium down into the valley where it begins to open up into the Ruhr from Diekirch to Aachen. And we went through Diekirch where a very great part of the battle from the Schnee Eifel, the Battle of the Bulge, took place. And here were those buildings just so full of holes and pockmarked, every building you looked at had all kinds of machine gun and mortar and so on, bullet holes in it, far as the eye could see. Only a few years later, there was none of that left. I would doubt very much, unless they've got it preserved in a park somewhere, that the average traveler to Central Europe could find any evidence at all of World War II anymore, unless it's just to go to visit a military graveyard like the big American one in Luxembourg. But as I think now about how he began immediately to say, no, this isn't going to be then the great tribulation that leads toward the day of the Lord. Christ is not going to come then, apparently, in the middle 1940s. It's going to take a lot longer, he began to say. Germany has got to rise again. But the point is the historical significance of a man who was preaching Germany will rise again while Germany was being destroyed. Now, did Germany rise again?
Has it risen again? Is it a tremendous power in Central Europe? You've been reading the newspapers lately about the Bader-Meinhof gang and about the political consequences these brutal assassinations and kidnappings are going to have. If you want to gamble with me that the German people are just like the United States in our riots of the 60s when 65 American cities were in flames and the students were burning down our college campuses and we were having race riots all over the place, you and I are both crazy. Because the Germans don't react the way we do. They don't survive utter, total national chaos such as a Great Depression and vast joblessness and then anarchy in the streets. When that begins to happen, the German people scream for a strong, powerful leader. They want a Führer to come and straighten things out. And there are thousands of German people that go around and shake their heads when they hear about these assassinations. And they see great steel fences and machine gun carrying guards with their peaked hats and their jackboots walking around the private residences of every leader in government, of every major millionaire and industrialist in the Ruhr, of everybody who is anybody, to protect them. They've got a siege mentality going over there to protect them from some young student types who are leftist, Marxist, Leninist, revolutionaries in West Germany. Now, our American papers are starting to speculate on whether or not there is going to be a violent turn to the right in Germany, in West Germany. We still have the problem of a divided Germany. We still have the problem of a divided Europe, of the Warsaw Pact nations. I want to just tell you some little interesting things. This hasn't anything to do with anything, except most people are ignorant of it. Most Americans never heard of the Alpha Jet, I suppose. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily better than the Mirage F-1. Doesn't mean that it's better than our Northrop, or is it North American, I forget, F-16 that we're selling to the NATO nations that I saw at the Paris Air Show. It just means that it's built by the Germans in Germany, for Germany, with the German Iron Cross on it and flown by German pilots is all that it means. Now, when I saw that the Japanese government recently was going to purchase about 161 big Orions, which is a kind of a military version of the Electrojet, prop jet, from Lockheed, I went on to read, and I imagine most American people thought, oh, isn't that great? The Burbank plant will really be busy. No, you see, that's made over there in the environs of Tokyo, and it has been for the last 20-some years, under license. Now, if you've read recently, the Japanese Zen, isn't that, some of you Japanese students know, I don't know how to count in Japanese. Is it Zen? Is the first, is means one? I think it is, like Zen Buddhism. Anyway, the zero, if Zen is in error, I beg your pardon, but the Zero was the fighter that Japanese had throughout all World War II. It never did really basically improve upon that. But the Zen is out now. It's a jet. It's a supersonic jet. It's a very maneuverable one, and it's being manufactured in quantity by the Japanese. Designed, built in Japan by the Japanese. Most Americans, if they've never been there, don't have the faintest idea that the Japanese economy and Japanese technology is in many ways superior to that of the United States. I would not want to be quoted on this, but I think that I once read a stat here fairly recently that said that on a per capita basis, the Japanese have more telephones and more television and more transistor radios per person than we do in the United States. And they also already have this talkophone thing to where at least some limited use is being given. Some Japanese people that can afford it, where you pick up a telephone, you dial a number, and you actually are being photographed by a TV camera, and you see the person in a little tiny video tube at the other end of the line. We tend to just, you know, we drift along in our day-to-day way of life. We don't really realize what is happening in the rest of the world, that there are vast and powerful economies and vast and powerful technologies that are as capable or more capable than the United States of designing and producing some of the implements of modern warfare. I mean, I've flown a French-built Falcon jet for about 9 years and have grown to really respect the French technology and of how absolutely sophisticated and intricate that kind of equipment really is. So when I learn that German tanks are superior to American tanks, they are faster, they're lower to the ground, they have more powerful cannon, they have snorkels, and they can actually swim the rivers, and that we don't, instead of just taking a little lesson from the Japanese and just designing one exactly like that. Oh, we wouldn't think of that. General Motors or whatever subsidiary, wherever they are, I don't know where they are, must have some little tiny factory somewhere that turns out some of those inferior tanks for some of these army people to play around with. But they're no good for anything. It's about like it was in World War II. Here, Howard Hughes, that the whole world passed up to some kind of an eccentric who happened to be one of the greatest aircraft designers and innovators of all of history, designed his H-1 Racer. And that H-1 Racer, when I was a tiny baby boy back in the early 1930s, set the world land speed record of 356.22 miles per hour at sea level, right over here at Burbank. He had two versions of it, a wide wing and a short wing, and the wide wing broke all the records that stood for many, many, many years of cross-country flight from New York to Miami, and also from Los Angeles to New York in something just over 6 hours way back in that time. That racer just simply sat down there in a hangar. And instead of the United States taking a look at it, the Germans copied some of the idea, and it seemed to crop up in their Focke Wulf 190 a little later on. But we didn't. We never seem to have that. We don't have a warlike nature. We're not necessarily interested in that kind of thing, but these other countries really are. Most Americans are utterly ignorant of the fact that supersonic jet aircraft are manufactured in Germany by Germans for Germans, and that supersonic jet aircraft are manufactured in Japan. We're ignorant of the fact that the Japanese lead the world in shipbuilding, that they build great, super, unbelievable 200,000-ton deadweight super ore and oil carriers that can be operated by a computer with a crew of 15. If you think that in a matter of a few years the Japanese could not answer the growing Russian naval threat way before the United States ever does, then you're wrong. Because I have already predicted, because I think it's going to happen, that we are going to see the Japanese Navy advance to become one of the largest fleets and one of the most sophisticated that the world has ever known. And we're living in the offing of those days, I firmly believe. So I ask our brethren down in San Diego, as we reminisced about 25 whole years that had gone by, just where are we today? How far have we come in these 25 years? We got a little mesmerized with numbers, with numerology, with a lot of ideas about cycles. We began to see how a lot of things seemingly fit into place. 19-year cycles, a lot of dates and figures seemed to fall in place. It was real cute, subtracting 7 years insanity while Nebuchadnezzar was running around the backyard eating herbs and tulips and deciding that that part of the time of punishment on the Gentiles for the time of the Gentiles could be subtracted. And therefore, we could simply bring the date back to about 1975 instead of 1982. I don't know if anyone has gone and revised the actual date for the fall of Babylon, 538 B.C., but let's see now. It seemed to me the last time I worked that out, if I took 538 and put it down on a piece of paper and took 2520 and put it above it and subtracted the 538 from it, I came out with about it was 539. That was what was the matter. It was October. It was the fall of 539. Then you got to add one. It still comes out 1982, if you'd care to do that. Now, I'm not going to predict that 1982 is the end of the times of the Gentiles. I'm just going to say that if the fall of Babylon on the night of Belshazzar's feast that you read of in the fifth chapter of the book of Daniel is the beginning of the time of the Gentiles, and if God's word says, which it does, every day is a year being fulfilled in prophecy, that span of time was to last for 2,520 years exactly, I'm just going to tell you that it does terminate in 1982. I'm not going to tell you anything has to happen in 1982. I'm not going to tell you the United States has gone down the drain before that, or the great economic collapse is coming next year, or the year after, or that Germany is going to unite with 10 nations, or that the Pope is going to move to Palestine. I'm not going to tell you anything else. I'm just going to say, if the times of the Gentiles began in 539 B.C., and if they're to last for 2,520 years, then they end in 1982. Those two ifs. Now, you can take your pick about that. But I think this. I think that we need to realize where we are today. That since 1950, the United States has never made a major overseas or a foreign policy decision without taking into account what the Kremlin thought about it, because we knew they had the atomic bomb. And that today there are six major nations that have the atomic bomb, and yesterday the stupid Chinese exploded one in the atmosphere again. So we're going to be breathing that over here. It's going to fall down and affect our cattle and our lettuce and our milk. We're going to get another dash of strontium 90 in our blood because people insist on testing these atom bombs up into the atmosphere. But we need to understand very carefully what Jesus said in the 21st chapter of the book of Luke. We've quoted that so many times, it's practically worn out in our minds, as Ted Herlofson said in the sermonette. We take it sort of commonplace. He said, when they asked him what would be the time of the end, when would these things happen, what would be the sign? Verse 8, take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I'm the Christ, and the time draws near. I have never seen a larger burst of evangelism than in the last very few years in the United States. The Jesus People movement never did really get going, kind of fell apart, and we have all these various youth groups. But I mean just in what I would call fundamental and somewhat charismatic Protestant evangelism. It seems like everybody is jumping on the bandwagon. And you know that many of them are using this chapter and the 24th chapter of Matthew, many a prophet, many a preacher, by the dozens in the United States, on television, in print, on the radio, are talking about wars and rumors of wars, about droughts and famines, about earthquakes, about pestilence, and about the imminency of the Great Tribulation. I'm here to tell you that dozens of them are. I picked up whole page ads from religious organizations of taking major world events just like we do, and hooking them directly to Matthew 24 and Revelation 6. I've seen it over and over again. But none of them, not one of them, identifies the United States of America as Manasseh and part of Joseph. And not a one of them says that the Great Tribulation happens here. They then go on to preach about the rapture. They say we're nearing the time of the tribulation, but you're going to be whisked away. They talk about the tribulation being a global problem of global pollution and global overpopulation and global earthquakes and global drought and global famine, and they're right about that. But they only go so far, and there they stop, because they do not have the uniqueness of this church, God's church, the only church that is God's true church on the face of this earth that has been given the key to understand biblical prophecy. Now, we got in a hurry. Just like preachers did during the American Revolutionary War, who thought time can't go on, this has got to be the time of the end. We got in the same kind of hurry Martin Luther did when he wrote, surely the end of all things is upon us and time cannot go on any longer. We got in a little bit of a hurry back in the 50s when we were young and beginning and full of enthusiasm and excitement, sitting and discovering new things out of the Bible and breathtakingly writing down all of our notes and learning every day. Practically every sermon that was preached in those days out of the pulpits at the feast was a new doctrine. We couldn't learn it seemed fast enough. We were alert and on our toes and just instantly aware of what was happening in the world. But now today, that we are 25 years closer to those events, about half of the church is sound asleep. And we got people in the audience who shake their head, no, we don't believe we're Israel anymore. That's rather hard for me to accept. Now, we've had to make some corrections. We've had to make some changes. You've been seeing what's happening in the American Episcopalian Church? They're having a vast breakaway movement now. The breakaway group are going to elect new bishops, and they're going to set up a whole new church. They're condemning the main body of being the real breakaways and saying that they are sticking to the truth. And, of course, in one sense, they are, at least the truth as they had seen it in the past, which meant that they were at least going to follow the biblical precept where it said your women are to keep silence in the church and that a woman is not to preach. And the Episcopal Church happens to believe that, at least the breakaways do. Now, the broad Episcopal Church had a lot of scholars. And you know what a scholar is. A scholar, when he sees here that women should not preach, sees that differently than you do because his eyes are scholarly eyes. And scholarly eyes change all that around. And to him it says women obviously should preach, given the right times and circumstance, and the NEA, and the NRA, and the NIA, and the effeminate this and that and the other movement. Not effeminate, what am I saying? That's a gay rights movement. And so he sees it differently. I used to tell the students in class, you know, a geologist picks up a rock, he doesn't just see a rock, he sees all sorts of things. Not really, I'm kidding, of course, he just really sees a rock. But the thing is, somebody colored his glasses in classes. And going through school, he learned to see all kinds of things that aren't really there. Well, the same is true of some of these so-called scholars, that they can get together and they can kind of reason, argue, and wheedle around. And pretty soon the Bible doesn't mean what it says. It doesn't even mean what it used to say. And so they change doctrine. Well, we've had to correct error. We've had to try to warn people, as I did desperately, year after year after year. And in spite of the fact I did that, people still tried to browbeat us and claim that we had everybody looking for the end of the world. And it has appeared in newspapers and in magazines that we predicted the end of the world in 1972. And anybody says that is an absolute, unbelievable, idiotic liar. It never happened. Nobody ever predicted it. Nobody ever said there was going to be the end of the world in 1972. I've got my sermon notes, and some people, I'll bet, Karen, I bet you were there in 1966. I'm not sure. In 1966, on the Feast of Trumpets, that was just a few days ago. 66, how many years is that? 11 years ago. 66 is a long time, because the Six-Day War happened just barely after I preached that sermon in Israel. And I had just been down to Egypt and Israel, and I had been to Petra. When I went to Petra, because I'd been involved in planning the Feast of Tabernacles, I'm standing there, I got a picture of me doing that up there in Wallace Studio, I think, with a portable microphone, and I'm standing in Petra in this beautiful big Greek amphitheater, whatever it was, and here's a Jordanian army helicopter buzzing overhead, and about 250 tourists walking around down below, and I'm supposed to believe that this is a place we're going to go creeping off in our private cave with our can of orange juice and wait for the coming of the Lord. And I began to realize, look, there are things like mortars and helicopters and hovercraft and bombers and high-altitude bombers and IRBMs and ICBMs and atomic bombs and all this stuff about a sea closing on people to fulfill that prophecy about the water coming out of the serpent's mouth, but the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood that came out of the serpent's mouth, is nonsense. It's not going to happen here, and it's not going to happen now. And so I stood in the pulpit in Brigham Wood on the British campus, on the Feast of Trumpets in 1966, and said, we're not going to Petra, folks. Now, we didn't go, did we? We didn't go to Petra. The years that went by, and I kept on trying to tell people, now, wait just a minute. Let's not set dates. I know that in the two Feasts of Tabernacles, just prior to that time, both times my sermons were on the subject of not depending upon any dates like 72 or 75 or any other dates. And we tried desperately, all the ministers did, to prepare the people, look, the papacy has not risen up, there hasn't been some vast ecumenism, there has not been a return of vast American and British bodies to the papal fold yet. The Pope is not in Palestine. They haven't even set up a cornerstone and dedicated it. There is no attempt at building a new temple. Some idiot over in Britain fabricated a dumb article, and some of our ministers were gullible enough to swallow it, and it was even trying to get into the PT. Pink stones are lying on the dock in New Jersey on their way, already pre-cut and numbered, going to put up a temple in Jerusalem. I sent Lily Christofferson, hustling back there in a 182 with a camera around his neck. I had him contact every quarry in the whole East Coast of the United States. We called every one of them. Every one of them says it's a lie. And yet it appeared in a religious publication in Britain, and some of our ministers swallowed it, and they wanted to put it in the plain truth. I like to check out that kind of stuff. If they're going to build a temple in Jerusalem, I want to be the first to know about it, because it's important to me. It says in biblical prophecy something like that might happen. So I wanted pictures of that stone. I'd like to go along on the ship, watch them erected. I'd be sitting there with a microphone. I'm not going to just let it happen and quote somebody else. But it wasn't happening. It was just an absolute lie. I knew that Germany had to unite with 10 nations, but also expected a massive economic collapse to come in the United States, and that wasn't shaping up. Well, now it is shaping up. Because now we're so vulnerable that a 90-day period in this world can change everything. From what we know today to absolute chaos, and it can happen so fast it makes your head swim to think about it. All we've got to have is one of the worst winters we've ever had that looks like it might be shaping up. Then another war in the Middle East, which could happen any instant. An Arab oil embargo. I mean, any number of things could happen that could bring about exactly these things that we have been talking about for so many years. When Jesus talked about wars and earthquakes and all this, and how people would be martyred, he meant what he said. In verse 20 of the 21st chapter, he said, "When you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." In the broader sense, Jerusalem is already encompassed with armies. There is a siege condition that takes place over there right now. "Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains." Those that are in Judea were to go to the mountains. Now, Judea was the ancient Roman province. And that meant north, north, east, south, west. It didn't mean any particular direction. It meant up to some, no doubt. And it didn't mean that they had to go to a nation like Petra or a nation like Jordan and over to the Middle East. It meant just to go to the mountains. "And let them which are in the midst of it," right there in Judea, in the area of Jerusalem, "depart out," get out of that area. "And let not them that are in the countries," translated by some nations or Gentiles, other foreign countries, "enter thereinto." Why would a person in the Seattle, Washington church go all the way across those gorgeous, fabulous, unbelievable mountains up there? All the Cascades and the vastness of those eastern Washington plains, and then struggle through the Selway wilderness of Idaho, where you can't even take a motor vehicle, some of the greatest elk hunting country on the face of the earth, and along the Middle Salmon, maybe some of the unbelievable country. You could hide a whole Chinese army in there, and you'd never find them. And then go across all the plains, and go across the Appalachians, and end up in New York, standing waiting for the ship. Then go clear across the Atlantic, and then through the Mediterranean, land. Where are they going to land? Haifa? And then go through Israel, to Jordan, to get to Petra. When God's word says, "Let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto, for these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." I read Psalm 91, how we are to be protected under the shadow of the wings of the Almighty. And how Jesus is called in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy, the rock, that he is the rock, and how a mighty fortress is our God. That comes out of a psalm. That we can be protected because he said that thousands could fall. 10,000 at one hand, 5,000 at the other, but no plague shall come nigh thy dwelling. I reminded our brethren that the people of Israel were in the land when the plagues fell. And God made a difference in the land of Goshen. There was not a house where the firstborn was not dead, except within the same confines, the same city limits, where there was blood on the doorpost. Now, if you've accepted the blood of Jesus Christ, you can live in the same apartment house, and somebody else is knocked off, and you are protected. It just happens to be that God has the power to protect you wherever you are. You don't have to go running off to some cave, unless God himself gives you the same kind of a trip that he gave Ezekiel. He picked Ezekiel up by the hank of his head and took him and showed him Jerusalem and a temple and took him back and plunked him down to the river Kabor in the concentration camp again. Ezekiel had quite a trip and he wrote about it. Now, if God's going to do that, then that's where we're going to go. But we're never going to do like one character I remember years ago saved so much honey in his trailer house that the bottom of it was bulging. It was unbelievable. People were saving seeds. I had been to Petra. Where are they going to put seeds in Petra, for pity's sake? They can eat them. Maybe hold them out and try to catch a bird, but they're sure not going to grow anything over there. But people can get real buggy about places to creep off and hide, and I think it's a kind of a danger. "But woe be unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Do you know what that means? Jerusalem right now is trodden down of the Gentiles. Oh, I know you think it's in Israeli hands. Well, you're wrong, because the old city of Jerusalem is still in Arab hands. The Israeli government, of course, is over it, but the people who live there are Arabs. And there is an Arab mayor for the old city Arab part, the quarter of Jerusalem. And the Dome of the Rock, which really is the abomination of desolation that is still there, is a part, I believe, of the fulfillment of that prophecy. And we need to realize what God means when he says that. I want you to notice in 12th chapter of Zechariah, in verse 2, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And it's like a siege now, because they're surrounded by hostile Arab armies, and at the same time, those people, because of their clout through OPEC and our needed 44% of imported Arab oil, are willing to cooperate. As one vast scandal, absolutely breathtaking, hit the press here about 6 or so months ago, showing how many large American corporations were cooperating with an Arab embargo. Of course, the JDL, the Jewish Defense League, and everybody else, B'nai B'rith, and everyone starts attacking them, and this is hideous, and they shouldn't be doing it. But nevertheless, it is like a siege mentality, because the Arabs are trying to blockade even the flow of goods, let alone the flow of military supplies. It says here, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem, and in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. And today it is. It is a very grave worry for the United States government, British, French, West German, Japanese, all the Arabs, Soviet Union. There isn't a government in this world that is not very deeply concerned about what goes on in Jerusalem, the capital of three of the major religions of this world. For all that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. And in that day, says the Eternal, I will smite every horse with astonishment and his rider with madness, and I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. In that day, verse 6, I will make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood and like a torch of fire in a sheaf, and they shall devour all the people round about on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. The Eternal shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. But other prophecies show that before that happens, everything the Israelis have built up in the nation of Israel is going to come down. So now, where are we? Well, we live in a time when the Israeli government possesses at least 18 to 20 atomic bombs. And now what I told you in this auditorium a year or two or whatever it was ago, just after the Entebbe, is that a year or two or 6 months, I forget, but after the Entebbe incident, has cropped up in major news releases in American publications. Now I have seen some of the leading columnists in the United States in big newspapers worrying openly about the so-called Samson complex of the Israeli government, which is why I asked Abba Iban that question on the televised interview following his address here the other night about the Samson complex. Israeli people are no longer willing to be taken away like sheep into the cattle cars and told they're going to be given a shower and find out that isn't water coming out of those pipes. They say now that if this were to come to pass, to where it appeared that Haifa and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem were going to be leveled by the Arabs, or they were going to be driven into the sea or exterminated, that they would prefer to pull down the temple of humanity. If they go, they say, we all go. And the article I read quoted people who had been interviewed on the streets in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv in Israel, where they were asked, do you mean to say that it doesn't make any difference to you that if you people have a war here, you would unleash the atomic bomb? It doesn't make any difference to you that that might send the whole world into a nuclear holocaust? And the answer was, if it means Israel dies, I couldn't care less. So that mentality is in the news now, and we know that it must be a part of the mentality of the present far-right Israeli government. Did you see where a friend that I have met and spent an afternoon with, Moshe Dayan, it's strange how he could have been on the one hand a defense minister under the Eshkol government, at the same time foreign minister under the Begin government. It's switching rather dramatically from one side of the government in Israel to the other, but that's where he is right now. And he was the hero of the 1967 war. He stopped off in Paris, apparently because of security reasons, just today, traveling around the world. So I would say to everybody, and especially to any old pioneers that remember those days in San Diego 25 whole years ago, we are 25 years closer to where we thought we were in the early 1950s. Not further away, closer by 2 decades and a half. You want to bet? that nothing significant's going to happen in 1982? I wouldn't take it. I'm not that much of a gambler.